You know, there is this very specific physical sensation you get when you've been carrying a heavily loaded backpack for hours on a really long hike.
Oh, yeah. Your shoulders just completely ache.
Right. The straps are just digging into your collarbones. Your posture completely changes to accommodate the bulk. And after a while, you just kind of accept it. Like, this is how walking feels now.
Yeah, the weight just becomes your baseline reality.
Exactly. And the human brain is so incredibly adept at normalizing that discomfort, you stop noticing the backpack itself.
You just start to operate under this assumption that, I don't know, gravity is somehow stronger for you, or that moving through the world is just inherently a struggle.
Right. And it isn't until you finally unclip that chest strap and you just drop the bag to the dirt and stand up straight that you
That you've
realize,
been carrying an extra 80 pounds this whole time.
yes, that feeling of sudden, shocking lightness. You know, that rush of blood returning to your shoulders, that is exactly what we're unpacking in today's deep dive. But we aren't talking about hiking gear or alpine trails here.
No, definitely not.
We are talking about the specific bone-deep ambient exhaustion of living in one of the most incredible but relentlessly expensive environments on Earth,
New York City.
New York City. And more importantly, we're looking at what actually happens to a person's life when they finally decide to drop the bag.
It's a fascinating sociological and economic phenomenon, really. We're looking at this very striking trend of New Yorkers, people who often genuinely love their city.
Right, they thrive on the energy.
Exactly. But they are finding themselves mathematically and honestly emotionally compelled to leave. And they aren't just doing the traditional tri-state area migration.
No, they're not just like hopping over to Westchester, New Jersey.
Right. They are looking for a complete paradigm shift. They're eyeing a very specific landing pad, roughly 2,400 miles away, which is Bellingham, Washington.
So the mission for this deep dive is to look at the actual mechanics of why this is happening. And I want to establish the ground rules right out of the gate here. This isn't a hype piece.
Right, no sugarcoating.
We are not here to sell you on the Pacific Northwest, and we certainly aren't here to bash New York. We're going to take a really unvarnished, purely numbers-driven look at the trade-offs of this massive cross-country relocation.
Which is so needed because people over-romanticize this stuff.
They really do. And we're pulling all of our insights today from a brutally honest relocation guide written by Gennaro Schaffer. He's a Bellingham real estate broker who handles this exact New York to Bellingham migration, like on a regular basis.
Yeah, he sees the reality of it every day.
Right. So we have all the raw data, the tax mash, the climate realities, and the profound lifestyle shifts right in front of us.
And grounding this in reality is crucial, you know. Relocation at its core, it's never really about finding a flawless utopia. It is always a transaction.
The transaction,
Yeah,
yeah.
you're simply exchanging one set of problems for another set of problems. The goal of a move like this is just to ensure you are consciously choosing the set of problems you actually prefer to deal with.
Right, like you might be trading intense financial stress for weather-related stress.
Exactly. Or trading cramped physical spaces for a slower, maybe more isolated social life. It's about moving from a default state of living into a highly intentional state of living.
So let's start with the catalyst, because before we can even begin to explore what life looks like in a mid-sized city in Washington State, we really have to look at the financial pressure cooker that is actively driving people out of the five
Yeah,
boroughs.
the math is staggering.
It really is. The raw real estate numbers in this guide outline what is essentially a breaking point. Let's look at the mechanics of this, what the guide calls the equity reset.
The breaking point is almost always a sudden realization of how much equity is tied up in mere daily survival. The sheer disparity in the math is what triggers those initial Zillow searches at 2 a.m.
Yeah, the doom scrolling on Zillow.
Right. According to the Q2 2026 data in our source material, the median Manhattan condo sits at around $1.6 million.
Wow.
And if you own that condo and you decide to sell it, after your broker fees, the city transfer taxes, and other transaction costs, you are netting roughly $1.5 million.
And we should contextualize what a $1.6 million condo in Manhattan actually is for people who don't live there.
It's not a mansion.
No, we are not talking about a sprawling penthouse. We are likely talking about a one bedroom, maybe like a small two bedroom if you're in a less transit accessible neighborhood or in a fifth floor walk-up building.
Right, where you might literally have a stroller parked in your bathtub
Yeah.
because there's zero closet space.
Yes. I have friends who literally do that. That is the reality of the square footage.
And even if you look outside Manhattan to find more space, Brooklyn sits at a median of $882,000. Queens and Westchester are hovering around that $650,000 to $750,000 range.
Which is still incredibly steep for what you actually get.
It is. Now, contrast that regional pricing with Bellingham, where the median single-family home, and by that I mean a standalone structure with no shared walls and an actual private yard, is currently sitting between $630,000 and $650,000.
Okay, let's walk through the worked equity example from the guide. Because seeing the actual math play out here is, honestly, it's staggering.
It really changes your perspective.
It does. Imagine you're that Manhattan owner. You sell your one bedroom in Murray Hill for $1.6 million. You clear your $1.5 million. You then fly 2,400 miles across the country and buy a genuinely excellent home in Bellingham.
A real home.
A real home. We are talking about a four-bedroom house, a real yard, maybe a view of Bellingham Bay or the Cascade Mountains, depending on the neighborhood. And it costs you $750,000.
Right.
You write a check, you pay in all cash, you now have zero mortgage.
And crucially, you still have $750,000 in liquid cash just sitting in your bank account or your investment portfolio.
Wait, let's just pause on that. The thing you are living in, this tiny, incredibly expensive box in the sky, transforms into a fully paid off four-bedroom house plus $750,000 in the bank.
It's insane.
It feels like unlocking a glitch in the financial matrix.
That phenomenon is exactly what the broker calls the equity reset.
Mm-hmm.
And the psychological impact of executing that reset, it goes far beyond a balance sheet.
How so?
Well, when we talk about that heavy backpack, a massive portion of that weight for a New Yorker is their monthly burn rate. Your ability to survive in the city is tethered to generating a massive amount of income month after month, year after year, just to maintain a baseline standard of living.
Just to not drown.
Exactly. When you execute this geographic arbitrage, you're decoupling your existence from that relentless burn rate. Waking up without a mortgage hanging over your head alters your entire relationship with work and with stress.
And the guide makes a point to say that it isn't just the property owners who feel this relief, right? Renters benefit from the flip as well.
Huge benefits for renters.
If you've been paying, say, $4,200 a month for a Manhattan two-bedroom, which honestly might be a deal depending on where you are, you can transition that exact same monthly cash output into a 20% down mortgage on a $650,000 home in Bellingham.
The mechanics of that shift are vital. Instead of enriching a landlord and watching, what, 50 grand a year vanish into the ether without building any personal wealth. Right, gone. You are diverting that same capital stream into an asset you actually own. You're stabilizing your long-term financial picture without increasing your monthly burden at all.
But the equity from the sale or, you know, transitioning from renting to owning, that's really only half the story here.
It is. The initial transaction is just a massive one-time financial event.
Right, because what dictates your day-to-day reality year after year are the carrying costs. And this is where we have to talk about the hidden tax of New York real estate, which is maintenance fees and common charges.
The silent killer of wealth.
Truly. If you own a co-op or a condo in New York, you are paying these fees every single month. The guide notes these can easily range from $1,500 to $3,500 a month.
And it's important to understand why those fees even exist. Mm-hmm. In New York, especially in older co-ops, you are paying for the upkeep of massive aging infrastructure.
Sure, the bones of the building.
Right. You're paying for boiler systems, roof replacements, the doormen, elevator maintenance, and increasingly, the compliance costs for new city environmental regulations like Local Law 97.
Oh, right. Those massive retrofitting mandates.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You are subsidizing the existence of a massive building. When you buy a single family home in Washington, that entire shared infrastructure cost just vanishes.
I look at a $3,000 monthly maintenance fee as a $36,000 annual line item in your budget.
Which is an entire salary in some parts of the country.
It really is. It's essentially like renting a very expensive luxury treadmill that you are forced to keep in your living room. You pay an exorbitant amount for it every single month, but you never actually own it.
Yeah.
And you never build a dime of equity on it. It just keeps you running in place.
That is a perfect analogy.
When you move to a single family home in Bellingham, you basically throw the treadmill out the window. Deleting a $36,000 mandatory non-equity building expense from your life, I mean, that changes your entire trajectory.
It changes what professional risks you can take.
Mm.
It alters your retirement timeline by decades, literally.
Mm.
And it fundamentally lowers your baseline level of ambient anxiety.
Yeah, just breathing room.
Exactly. This is why the broker specifically notes that particular kind of exhaustion. These are highly educated, hardworking professionals earning really strong incomes, but they're squeezed so tightly by the structural costs of their environment that they have very little wealth to show for it.
But deleting the co-op fee is just one part of the carrying cost equation, which brings us to the quietest, but arguably the most impactful part of the relocation guide, and that is the invisible paycheck.
Yes, the tax swap.
We have to unpack this tax swap.
We're looking at a transition between two absolute extremes of the American tax spectrum here. New York has the highest combined income tax burden in the entire country.
It's brutal.
If you live in the city, you are hit twice. You have the New York state tax, which scales up to 10.9% for high earners. And on top of that, you have the New York City resident tax, which is up to 3.876%.
So wait, your top marginal rate on local taxes alone is hovering around 14.8% before you even factor in federal taxes.
Correct. Before the IRS even touches your money, the state and city take nearly 15%.
Okay, and Washington State, what does their income tax structure look like?
Washington State has no state income tax.
No.
None. And there is no local or city income tax of any kind. It is a flat zero.
Let's put concrete numbers on this, because discussing percentages always feels a bit abstract to me. The guide uses a household earning $250,000 a year as a benchmark.
A very realistic scenario for a dual income tech or finance couple.
Right. In New York, paying both state and city income taxes, that household is surrendering a massive chunk of their gross pay. The day they establish Washington residency, they immediately save between $15,000 and $22,000 a year.
Just by changing their address.
Every single year, they just stop paying it.
Compounded over a decade, that is $150,000 to $220,000 in retained earnings, just staying in your pocket.
Wow.
And that is strictly the income tax. That doesn't even account for the massive drop in property taxes.
Oh, right. Property taxes. What's the difference there?
Well, New York's effective property tax rate sits between 1.3% and 1.9%, depending on the county. Bellingham's property tax rate is roughly half that. It sits tightly between 0.74% and 0.81%.
The numbers are just undeniable. But the guide makes a really interesting psychological observation here. It points out that New Yorkers planning this move tend to vastly underweight the income tax savings, while they hyper-focus on highly visible daily costs, like, you know, the price of groceries.
Yeah, it's a huge blind spot.
Why do people miss the forest for the trees when it comes to 20 grand in tax savings?
It comes down to human psychology and how we process friction. Income taxes withheld at the payroll level, right? It is entirely invisible to the earner.
Yeah, you never see it.
You never actually hold that $22,000 in your hands, so you don't feel the physical pain of handing it over to the government. It's just a slightly smaller number on a digital pay stub that you glance at maybe twice a month.
Out of sight, out of mind.
Exactly. But when you walk into a corner bodega in Manhattan and a basic carton of eggs costs $9, that is a highly visible, visceral transaction. You feel the sting of that markup every single Tuesday. The friction is constant.
So they get to Bellingham, and their grocery bill drops back down to the national average, which provides this immediate dopamine hit of feeling like life is cheaper.
Right. They feel that instantly.
But let's pause and look at the whole ledger here. Because Washington State still has to fund its roads, its schools, and its infrastructure. If they aren't taxing income, they are getting that money from somewhere else.
Oh, absolutely. They find a way.
And the guide is very upfront about the costs that stay the same or actually go up. Sales tax is essentially a wash, right? It's about 8.8% in both places.
Yeah, roughly the same.
But let's look at transportation. In New York, you likely don't own a car. In Bellingham, you absolutely must own a car to function. And Washington gas taxes push pump prices to $4 or $4.30 a gallon.
Very high gas taxes, yes.
Yeah. So I have to wonder, does the sheer cost of buying a vehicle, insuring it, paying for regular maintenance, and buying heavily taxed gas effectively wipe out that perceived savings of the 0% income tax?
That is the exact reality check the broker forces clients to confront.
Yeah.
The mechanics of Washington's revenue system rely really heavily on the gas tax, high vehicle registration fees, and property taxes to make up for the lack of income tax.
Right.
So, does a car wipe out the savings? The short answer is no, it doesn't wipe it out, but it certainly eats into the margin.
How much margin are we talking?
Well, if you were saving $20,000 a year on income tax and you go out and finance a reliable SUV, your car payment, insurance, maintenance, and gas might come out to maybe $8,000 or $10,000 a year.
Okay, so you are still netting a massive positive gain of $10,000.
Yes, mathematically you are ahead. But the psychological shock is very real. It's the sudden introduction of a completely new category of liability. You aren't used to worrying about the lifespan of brake pads or whether someone is going to steal your catalytic converter.
That makes total sense. I mean, in New York, your transportation cost is a 2.90 subway swipe.
Right.
If the train breaks down in the tunnel, that's incredibly annoying, but it's the MTA's financial problem.
Oh,
in Bellingham, if your transmission blows on Interstate 5, that is a $3,000 problem that belongs exclusively to you.
It is a profound mental shift from public infrastructure reliance to private infrastructure maintenance. However, structurally speaking, when you combine the income tax deletion with the erasure of those $3,000 a month co-op fees and the drastic reduction in your mortgage principal.
The addition of a car is just a drop in the bucket.
Exactly, a mathematical drop in the bucket. The financial math remains heavily weighted and favors the relocation.
Okay, so if the financial math is that overwhelmingly positive, there has to be a catch. You don't just get handed $750,000 in equity, zero income tax, and a beautiful four-bedroom house without paying a toll somewhere in the universe.
No, the universe always balances the scales.
And that toll is hanging right above your head. We have to do the honest climate check. We have to talk about the sky.
The climate section of the guide is where the broker admits they actually lose a certain percentage of prospective buyers.
Really? Just from reading the weather stats.
Yes. And they're explicit that they would rather lose a client while reading the guide than have them realize it after they have closed on a house and unpacked all their boxes.
Because it is a profound sensory shift. Let's look at the actual precipitation data, which honestly is completely counterintuitive to me.
It surprises everyone.
New York actually gets significantly more total precipitation than Bellingham. New York gets about 50 inches of rain and snow a year. Bellingham only gets about 36 inches.
Right.
But it's not the volume of water, is it? It's the delivery system.
Yeah.
New York has 234 sunny days a year. Bellingham has roughly 230 days that are cloudy or completely overcast.
That metric right there is the crucial distinction. New York's climate is characterized by violent extremes. You have those hot, sticky, deeply humid summers.
Oh, they're terrible.
The guide vividly points out that an 84-degree day in August in Manhattan, combined with the heat radiating off the concrete buildings and venting up from the subway grates.
Oh, that subway grate air. It's awful.
It's a physically oppressive experience. And conversely, the winters are sharp, biting, and snowy, with temperatures averaging around 26 degrees in January.
Yeah, the wind whipping off the Hudson River will literally cut right through a heavy wool coat. It hurts your face just to walk to the deli to get a coffee.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But Bellingham is the exact opposite of extreme. The summers are universally described as spectacular.
Spectacular.
July and August, highs hover around 72 to 75 degrees. There's virtually no humidity. The guide notes that locals start complaining about the heat when it hits 85 degrees.
Oh, New Yorkers would kill for an 85-degree cap.
Right. You can sleep with the windows open. You don't have that swampy, stagnant air. If you survived 10 years of New York subway summers, stepping out into a 72-degree crisp Bellingham July must feel like the climate is formally apologizing to you for everything you've endured.
It is an apology, and it sounds glorious. But that apology has a strict expiration date, and that date arrives in November.
Yes, it does.
The Bellingham winter is the true test of the transplant's resilience. From November through late February, it is relentlessly, uniformly gray.
Just a wall of gray.
The rain isn't dramatic, right? You rarely get thunderstorms. It is a light, persistent, misty drizzle spread over 9 or 10 months. The temperature rarely drops below 28 degrees, so you don't get the brutal, bone-chilling cold or the paralyzing snowstorms of New York.
But you also are completely deprived of the sun.
And this is where the psychological divide really opens up.
Oh, right.
Because a New York winter is physically brutal, but it is visually bright.
Very bright.
You have those days in February where it's 15 degrees outside, but the sky is this piercing, crystal clear blue, and the sun is literally blinding as it reflects off the snow.
You need sunglasses in February in New York.
You really do. In Bellingham, it's a physically mild winter. Like, you can get away with wearing a fleece and a light rain shell, but it is visually gloomy.
And the human brain, specifically your circadian rhythm, reacts very strongly to that lack of visual contrast and solar energy. The guide is incredibly upfront about seasonal affective disorder, or SAD.
Yeah, people joke about it, but it's serious.
It's not a punchline in the Pacific Northwest at all. It is a biological reality. Taking a dedicated vitamin D regimen and utilizing a full-spectrum light therapy lamp at your desk is standard operating equipment for locals.
Wow.
It's considered as essential as owning a good raincoat. You are trading coal for cloud. And for a New Yorker accustomed to bright, sharp winter light, that sensory deprivation can be heavily taxing on their mental health.
The broker strongly recommends taking a scouting trip in November or February before you even list your New York apartment. They basically say you need to go walk around in the gray drizzle and see how your body actually reacts to it.
Highly, highly recommended.
But wait, let's play that out. If I fly to Washington in February for a week, I mean, anyone can endure a drizzly week if they know they have a return ticket to sunny, albeit freezing, New York on Sunday. Can a five-day vacation really prepare you for the slow, relentless, cumulative drip of four consecutive months of gray?
It's a completely valid skepticism.
Hmm.
A week-long trip cannot replicate the cumulative toll of month four of an overcast sky. It just can't.
Right.
What the winter scouting trip does accomplish, however, is breaking the July fantasy. Because if a client only visits Bellingham in the summer, they are making a massive, life-altering financial decision based on an artificial best-case scenario sample.
They're buying the apology.
Exactly. The winter trip forces them to confront the baseline reality. The broker notes a distinct divergence in how clients react. Some people walk around the Fairhaven District in the February drizzle, duck into a coffee shop, and say it feels like a massive exhale.
Like it's cozy.
Yeah, they genuinely love the moody, cozy, introspective vibe. But others get very quiet on the drive back to the airport. They realize the lack of contrast, the lack of that kinetic solar energy, is an absolute deal-breaker for their neurochemistry.
They just know they can't do it.
Right. They know they'll be miserable.
So assuming you fall into the camp that can handle the gray, surviving the winter requires having a solid routine, right? A reason to get out of bed, and a very good light therapy lamp.
Definitely.
Which naturally brings us to a major logistical hurdle. How do you actually make a living when you move 2,400 miles away from your corporate headquarters? We have to look at the intersection of remote work and the local Bellingham economy.
This is where the structural changes of the post-pandemic world really enabled this specific migration pattern.
Yeah, none of this works without Zoom.
Exactly. The guide states that almost every single New York to Bellingham buyer they work with is remote, hybrid, or actively restructuring their consulting or freelance work as part of the move. The time zone math is a massive factor here.
Right, because Eastern time is 3 hours ahead of Pacific time.
So if you maintain your traditional 9-to-5 New York schedule, your day shifts to a 6 a.m. to 2 p.m. Bellingham schedule.
The legendary time zone hack.
People love the idea of it.
On paper, everyone loves it. You finish your workday at 2 p.m., you have your entire afternoon free, you can go hike Galbraith Mountain, pick up your kids, and run errands before dinner.
That's the pitch.
But wait, if I think about the reality of a 6 a.m. to 2 p.m. shift, doesn't that actually sound kind of brutal in practice? Especially in the winter.
Oh, it is.
The sun doesn't even rise until close to 8 a.m. in Washington in December. So you are waking up at 5:30 a.m. in pitch black, getting on Zoom calls with fully caffeinated New Yorkers who have already seen the sun and had their morning bagels while you are sitting in the dark under a therapy lamp trying to sound sharp.
It's exhausting just thinking about it.
And beyond the sleep deprivation, doesn't starting work at 6 a.m. deeply isolate you from your own town? You are completely missing the morning coffee shop run, the neighborhood school drop-off chatter, the local morning culture. Doesn't this schedule just make you an outsider in your own community?
That is the exact trap of the time zone hack. You are geographically present, but temporarily displaced.
Temporarily displaced, wow.
You're completely out of sync with your local geography. While your neighbors are easing into their day, walking their dogs, experiencing the morning light, you are locked in your home office in the middle of your core productivity hours.
Just grinding away on spreadsheets.
Right. And by the time your neighbors are ready to socialize after work at 5 p.m., you might be totally exhausted because you have been on since the pre-dawn hours. It requires a tremendous amount of discipline and intentionality to ensure that time zone misalignment doesn't become socially isolating.
And what if the remote work bubble bursts? What if your company mandates a return to the office, even just once a month? The guide goes into the air travel realities, and it makes it very clear that Bellingham is not a quick hop to the East Coast.
No, it is a full, grueling travel day. Bellingham International Airport, BLI, it's a highly convenient regional airport, but it only really services West Coast and Sunbelt destinations.
Like Vegas, Phoenix, that sort of thing.
Exactly. Oakland, maybe. To get to New York, you have to drive 90 miles south, which is about an hour and a half to 2 hours down Interstate 5, depending on Seattle traffic, to reach Seattle-Tacoma International Airport, SEA.
Okay, so a two-hour drive before you even park.
Yes. From there, you are looking at a 6.5-hour direct flight to JFK.
So door to gate, accounting for security, the drive, parking, you are looking at an 8 to 9 hour travel day just to get to the office.
It's basically a transatlantic flight in terms of total travel time.
If you have to do that once a quarter, it's an adventure. If you have to do it once a month, that is a grinding tax on your physical health. But the travel is manageable compared to the real risk, which is losing that remote job entirely.
Yeah, that's the danger zone.
Because the local job market in Bellingham is a completely different ecosystem.
The local economy is stable, but it is highly specialized. It is anchored by Peace Health, which is the regional hospital system, Western Washington University, retail, and maritime trades.
Right.
What it decidedly lacks is the corporate density of New York. There is no major finance sector, no media conglomerates, no Madison Avenue advertising agencies, and very few corporate law firms.
So moving to Bellingham is essentially a heavily leveraged bet on your ability to maintain your remote job. Because if you get laid off and have to find local W-2 employment in those specialized fields, you are going to face a very limited market and a highly significant pay cut.
A steep pay cut, yes. The lower cost of living will absorb some of that shock. But it is a major career pivot you have to be mentally and financially prepared for.
It is a risk assessment every buyer has to make. You are trading career mobility and corporate density for lifestyle and equity.
Yeah, you can't have both.
Okay, let's assume the remote job is secure, you've mastered the time zone hack, and you've made peace with the rain.
The dream scenario.
Right. The fantasy gets real. You have to figure out where exactly you are going to unpack your boxes. We need to get into the neighborhood matchmaking because this is where the identity crisis really hits the New Yorker.
Right.
You are confronting how you actually want to live.
The tension in this section of the guide is fascinating to me because it highlights a deep contradiction in the transplant's desires.
Oh, totally.
New Yorkers are fleeing the density of the city specifically to get space, to get a yard, to not share walls with neighbors. But they have this deeply ingrained, almost cellular need for walkability.
Yes.
They want half an acre of quiet land, but they also want to be able to walk to an artisanal bakery in 5 minutes.
Yeah.
And from an urban planning perspective, those two desires are usually geographically opposed.
Exactly. It's the psychological shock of moving from vertical living, where everything is stacked and immediate, to horizontal living, where things are spread out.
It takes adjustment.
The guide does this brilliant job of breaking down how a buyer's New York borough maps almost directly to their Bellingham neighborhood choice. It reflects their deeply held lifestyle preferences. Let's look at how this plays out, starting with Fairhaven.
Fairhaven is the historic village at the south end of Bellingham. It features preserved Victorian brick buildings, an independent bookstore, local coffee shops, a wine bar, and it's right on the water near the ferry terminal.
Sounds idyllic.
From an urban design standpoint, it is the natural landing pad for the Brooklyn and Lower Manhattan transplants. It offers that walk-out-your-door density, history, and architectural texture they miss, but in a much calmer package.
But I'm guessing you pay for that texture.
Oh, absolutely. Because of that preservation and walkability, homes here command a massive premium, running from $700,000 to well over $1.1 million.
Right, so Fairhaven is basically the West Village or Park Slope, but with towering pine trees instead of subways. It's for the person who wants to leave New York but still wants to feel like they're in a neighborhood.
Exactly, and then you have Edgemoor.
What's the vibe there?
Edgemoor is for the transplant who has reached a completely different conclusion. They say, I am leaving the city and I want the space I was denied for the last 20 years.
They just want to stretch out.
Right. It features mid-century homes, massive lots, mature landscaping, incredibly quiet streets, and sweeping water views over Bellingham Bay.
Wow.
It also runs in the $700,000 to $1.1 million plus range, but you are explicitly trading away walkability for sheer square footage, privacy, and quiet.
Then you have the more middle tier options, which are closer to the medium price point. You have South Hill, which features older character homes, is highly walkable to the downtown core, and is slightly more accessible at $550,000 to $850,000.
It's a good middle ground.
Yeah. And you have Say Home, which is right next to Western Washington University. It is incredibly bike friendly, has a younger, more transient academic vibe, and runs in the $580,000 to $750,000 range.
And then there is Berkeley.
Berkeley.
This is located on the northeast side of town, up a hill. It features newer construction, a more traditional suburban layout, wide streets, and attached two-car garages.
The classic suburban dream.
Right. But it was master planned to have a walkable village center with a grocery store, a movie theater, and restaurants. Barclay is essentially the Westchester or Long Island equivalent.
Okay, that makes perfect sense.
It's for the family looking for easy amenities, modern construction, and quiet streets. Priced around $550,000 to $750,000.
And if you want actual literal acreage, like if your fantasy is owning horses or having a massive garden, right, you have to look outside the city limits entirely to places in the wider county like Ferndale, Linden, or Birch Bay.
Yes, the county's where you get land.
But I have to make an observation about this horizontal living fantasy. New Yorkers constantly sit in their apartments and talk about wanting acres of land.
Oh, all the time.
But do they actually have any idea what to do with a massive yard once they own it?
Usually no.
I mean, when you live in a co-op, maintenance means calling the super when the sink leaks. When you own a half acre in the Pacific Northwest, maintenance means buying and maintaining a riding mower, cleaning gutters filled with wet, decomposing pine needles twice a year.
The pine needles are relentless.
Right. Battling moss on your roof, managing water drainage so your crawl space doesn't flood during the rainy season. It is literally a part-time job.
The romanticization of the yard rarely includes the manual labor of the yard. It is a massive structural lifestyle shift.
It's exhausting.
You're essentially trading the ambient psychological stress of the city for the physical, tangible responsibility of land management. Some transplants find that shift deeply grounding and meditative.
Oh, sure. They get into composting.
Yeah, they genuinely love learning how to compost, prune fruit trees, and maintain a garden. It connects them to the seasons.
And the others.
Others find it incredibly tedious, overwhelming, and expensive, and they end up paying local landscaping services a premium to handle all of it, which just adds another new line item to their budget.
So you've picked your neighborhood vibe. You want the historic walkability of Fairhaven or the attached garage in Barclay. Now we get to the wildest part of this entire guide. The mechanics of actually buying a massive financial asset when you live a 7 to 9 hour travel day away.
The long distance purchase? It's intense.
Buying a house site unseen or very close to it requires an immense amount of trust and a highly dialed in process. The guide details the remote workflow and it relies heavily on the broker acting as your proxy.
The process usually starts with strict alerts on the MLS, the multiple listing service, which is the database brokers use to share property listings.
Right.
Once a property hits the MLS, the broker goes out immediately and conducts rigorous FaceTime walkthroughs with the client back in New York.
And by rigorous, the broker means going into the dark attics, pointing the camera into the dusty crawl spaces, looking at the water heat.
Right, looking at the bones of the house.
And crucially, narrating the smells of the house and the ambient neighborhood noise that those highly curated listing photos intentionally hide.
I love the analogy of this being like online dating for real estate.
It totally is. You are sitting in Manhattan looking at these brightly lit wide-angle photos of a living room, and you're relying entirely on your broker to be the honest friend who says, listen, they used a weird lens to make the kitchen look huge, the basement smells distinctly like mildew, and there is a massive buzzing power line right outside the master bedroom window.
It requires absolute transparency. And then when a short list of viable homes is compiled over several weeks, the buyer flies in for a highly focused, exhausting 1 to 2 day weekend trip where they tour 6 to 8 houses, make a decision, and fly back to New York.
Which sounds completely terrifying.
It's a whirlwind.
Spending $750,000 on a structure, you spend exactly 45 minutes walking through. But the guide emphasizes that Washington state real estate laws actually protect the buyer in a way that makes this less insane than it sounds.
Much less insane.
We need to break down the jargon here. How exactly does the earnest money and the inspection contingency act as a safety net?
In Washington, to make a competitive offer, you put down an earnest money deposit to show you are a serious buyer. It's usually 1% to 3% of the purchase price, so roughly $6,500 to $19,500 on a typical home.
Okay, so that's locked in.
That money is held in escrow. But the contract includes a 10-day inspection contingency, and this clause has real legal teeth.
What does that mean in practice?
It means you have 10 business days to hire a licensed inspector to go through every single inch of that house. The foundation, the roof, the electric panel, the plumbing.
All the scary stuff.
Exactly. If they find problems, hidden water damage, a failing roof, and you are not comfortable taking on that risk, you can legally walk away from the deal for any reason relating to the inspection and get your entire earnest money deposit refunded.
Wow.
You are not locked into buying a lemon just because you made an offer from 2,400 miles away.
That is Massive. It gives you the psychological confidence to pull the trigger from across the country, knowing you have a legally binding parachute.
It's a game changer for remote buyers.
And when you contrast that streamlined process with the absolute nightmare of buying property in New York, I mean, the guide talks about the sheer relief clients feel during a Washington closing.
Oh, New York closings are notoriously awful.
In New York, if you buy a co-op, you are subjected to a board interview, which is basically a financial colonoscopy where neighbors decide if you are wealthy and socially acceptable enough to live in their building.
It's so invasive.
Then you have flip taxes, which is a fee, sometimes 1 or 2% of the sale price, that you have to pay directly into the building's reserve fund just for the privilege of selling your unit. You have attorney-driven delays that drag on for months.
The bureaucracy embedded in New York real estate is legendary and exhausting. Washington operates much more swiftly and relies on escrow and title companies rather than adversarial attorneys fighting over every comma.
Oh, that sounds so much better.
Closings are often handled digitally via DocuSign, and a mobile notary can actually be dispatched to your apartment in New York to collect the final physical signatures on the loan documents.
Wait, they come to your apartment?
Yes. The title transfers at the county courthouse, the keys are released to your broker, and the moving truck just shows up at your new house.
But all of this legal safety means nothing if you can't physically get your life across the country. And when you look at the sheer physics of moving out of a fifth-floor walk-up in Manhattan and driving those possessions 2,400 miles to a driveway in Washington,
it's a massive undertaking.
You realize you're funding a massive logistical operation. The guide estimates $9,000 to $22,000 plus for full-service interstate movers.
That's not cheap.
And financially, you might also need a bridge loan. For those who aren't in finance, a bridge loan essentially allows you to borrow money against the equity of your New York apartment to fund the cash purchase of the Washington house, bridging the gap before your New York place officially closes and the funds are released.
The logistics are incredibly heavy. It is a gauntlet.
Yeah, a total gauntlet.
But eventually, the bridge loan is paid off, the paperwork is signed, the movers have driven across the country, and the boxes are unpacked in your new living room. Which brings us to the reality of the aftermath.
The aftermath.
The actual lifestyle shift and the new social texture of your daily life.
It's your first Tuesday evening in Bellingham. You've survived the move. What does your life actually feel like now? The guide points out that the very first thing New Yorkers notice, almost on a visceral level, is the auditory shock.
The silence. The sheer drop in decibels.
Yes. In New York, the background track of your life is relentless. It is sirens echoing off skyscrapers, garbage trucks grinding metal at 4 a.m., the hum of traffic, your upstairs neighbor pacing the floorboards.
You can never escape the noise.
You are marinated in the noise and friction of 8 million people. Bellingham is deeply, profoundly quiet. The guide notes that some transplants actually find it eerie for the first week.
I can imagine.
They can hear the wind in the trees, and it unnerves them. And then suddenly, their nervous system regulates, and they realize they can never sleep in a noisy city again.
That auditory shift is the physical manifestation of what we can call deceleration. The entire pace of existence slows down. Your body is no longer braced for impact.
Braced for impact, wow.
And with that physical deceleration comes a necessary redefinition of what constitutes an inconvenience.
This part of the guide made me laugh out loud. It says that traffic in Bellingham means a crosstown trip takes 18 minutes instead of 12 minutes.
It's hilarious. The 45-minute subway commute, crammed into a metal tube shoulder to shoulder with stridgers, calculating delays, it's entirely gone. It is replaced by a 10-minute drive in your own car or a quiet bike ride.
Unbelievable.
But the real trade-off, the thing that closes the deal for most of these buyers, is the unprecedented accessibility to nature.
Let's talk about the nature access, because that is huge.
Trailheads at Galbraith Mountain or the Chuckanut Mountains are 15 minutes from your driveway. You are 20 minutes from launching a paddleboard in the bay. You are 90 minutes from world-class skiing at Mount Baker.
The paradigm of how you interact with nature shifts completely. In New York, getting to nature is a massive, stressful, planned weekend expedition.
You have to pack a cooler and leave at dawn.
Right. You are renting a car. You are sitting in gridlock traffic on the George Washington Bridge just to go look at some changing leaves in the Hudson Valley with 10,000 other people doing the exact same thing. In Bellingham, nature is a casual Tuesday after work activity.
It's literally in your backyard. But that physical deceleration brings a social reset that New Yorkers really need to brace for, and the guide explicitly warns about this transition.
Oh, the social aspect.
New York friendships are fast, intense, and heavily proximity-based.
Yeah.
You bond over the shared intensity, the friction of the city, the mutual complaints about the subway.
Complaining is a bonding language in New York.
Exactly. The Pacific Northwest, however, operates on a fundamentally different social frequency. People are unfailingly polite, but they are reserved.
We have to talk about the infamous Seattle freeze. Even though the guide says it is a slightly milder, friendlier version in Bellingham, it is still a very real sociological barrier.
Well, it's very real.
They estimate it takes a solid 6 months to break in and find your people, usually by forcing yourself to join a rec league, a hiking group, or becoming a recognized regular at a local coffee shop.
It takes deliberate effort.
But wait, let's look at the underlying mechanics of this freeze. Is the Pacific Northwest actually unfriendly? Or do they just have a deep, ingrained respect for privacy and personal space that boundaryless New Yorkers completely misinterpret as coldness?
That's a great framing.
In New York, you are living on top of each other, sharing subway poles and thin apartment walls. So oversharing and instant intimacy is a survival mechanism to build community in tight quarters. In Washington, people have physical space, so they respect psychological space.
The spatial geography dictates the social geography. It isn't hostility. It is a deeply embedded culture of non-intrusion.
Non-intrusion, exactly.
But to a New Yorker who is accustomed to immediate, abrasive, high-energy engagement, non-intrusion feels exactly like rejection. The withdrawal from that constant, spontaneous social friction can be genuinely tough.
So what does the broker recommend?
The guide's advice is to let it be its own slower thing. Don't force the New York pacing onto a Pacific Northwest interaction. Let people warm up to you.
And the culture shifts in other areas, too, particularly if you are moving with kids. The educational environment is a massive factor.
Huge factor.
Bellingham public schools are highly regarded, but the culture is vastly different from the hyper-competitive New York or Westchester districts. It is much more project-based, emphasizes outdoor education, and is notably less test-driven.
Yeah, there's less pressure.
The guide says parents often experience this as a massive relief, stepping off the admissions pressure cooker where you are stressing about preschool placements.
Higher education landscape is a major draw as well. Having Western Washington University right in town is a huge asset.
Oh, because of the tuition.
Yes. After 12 months of residency, your kids qualify for in-state tuition. For a New York family dreading the sticker price of East Coast private colleges, that math alone alters their financial legacy.
But you do trade away the global scale of culture. You trade Broadway and global Michelin-starred tasting menus for excellent local coffee roasters, fresh oysters pulled out of the nearby bays, and a really robust craft beer scene.
Places like Culshan, Boundary Bay, Aslan.
Yeah, the quality of life is fantastic, but it is deeply local. It is not the cultural center of the universe.
Which is the fundamental thesis of the entire relocation guide.
Yeah.
You are trading unparalleled cultural variety, bright sunny winter days, and intense kinetic energy for financial freedom, massive square footage, 0% state income tax, and unparalleled daily access to the outdoors.
It is the ultimate exchange of problem sets. And it brings us to a final lingering thought for you to ponder as we wrap up this deep dive.
Let's hear it.
We started by talking about that heavy backpack, the sheer exhaustion of carrying the financial, logistical, and ambient weight of New York City on your shoulders for years. But here is the profound thing about carrying a heavy weight for a long time. It builds very specific muscles.
It changes how you move.
Exactly. It shapes how you walk, how you stand, how you interact with the world, and how you define your own resilience.
The weight becomes a core part of your identity. You take pride in your ability to carry it.
Precisely. So the real question isn't just whether the math of moving to Bellingham works. We know the math works.
The numbers don't lie.
The question is, if you remove the 45-minute subway commute, if you delete the $3,000 monthly maintenance fee, if you strip away the constant ambient stress and the friction of city living, who do you actually become with all that extra time, money, and quiet?
That's the real unknown.
Is the identity of being a hardcore New Yorker partly just a trauma bond with a ridiculously high cost of living? And if you sever that bond, if you drop the backpack, are you ready to meet the person you become in the silence? Take your time weighing the math against the gray winters. We will see you on the next deep dive.